So what I'll talk about today is some work we've been doing on a class of systems called double perovskites. And in fact, the things I'll talk about will kind of follow some of the themes that Alan mentioned in his talk, namely the interplay of interaction effects driving magnetism and aspects of quantum Hall physics, quantum anomalous Hall physics. So ordered double perovskites are a class of oxide materials which form a simple cubic structure, but with two different atoms on the two different sublattices of this cubic lattice. Okay? So individually, each atom forms an FCC lattice. So if I have the blue or the purple atoms here, they form an FCC lattice, and then the yellow atoms form a second interpenetrating FCC lattice in this cubic crystal. So these materials are interesting for various reasons. So if we look at metallic systems, they are systems which are very high temperature ferromagnets very often. Okay? So they can have ferromagnetic TCs from 400 all the way up to 700 Kelvin. And so these are systems which are very high temperature ferromagnets, but they're also of interest because they are what are called half metals. Namely, there's only one type of carrier, one type of spin flavor that's active at the Fermi level. And so if one thinks about spintronics effects, such as if you want to think about spin injection, then these are ideal systems if one wants to consider physics of that. There is another class of these double perovskites, which are actually Mott-insulating perovskites, where one of these atomic things here, either the purple or the yellow, for instance, is chemically, electronically inert. And in those cases, you can get interesting physics of Mott-insulators, which live on the frustrated FCC lattice. So there is kind of this two-fold interest, and one can tune these, one can sort of have these purple and yellow atoms being various different types of transition metals. So there's a whole host of these compounds that are that people can study. So today I'll sort of touch upon two aspects of this. One is the idea that one can get topological states, and in particular I'm thinking of quantum anomalous Hall insulators by engineering these kinds of structures. And in particular I'll talk about one thing where we have a theoretical proposal for getting a quantum anomalous Hall insulator. And then we've been doing recently more work on the Mott-insulating varieties, where one can get interesting spin Hamiltonians. So time permitting, I'll sort of touch upon that. So this work done a number of students, including Kiran, who's here in the audience, and Yongjun Kim's group, where we collaborated on neutron scattering, also with Adam Axel at Oak Ridge. And we've kind of benefited a lot from discussions with Bruce Gollin and Yong Baek, both who are in the audience here. So the interest in topological phases, as Alan was mentioning, stems from sort of this old work on quantum Hall physics, but there is a lot of work in the last 6-7 years on thinking about topological insulators with interesting surface states, and very recently the identification of a quantum anomalous Hall insulator by taking topological insulator films doped with magnetic atoms like chromium or vanadium. And so the questions that we would like to sort of think about are, can one engineer correlated phases in these systems? Can interactions drive new types of phase transitions? So the quantum phase transitions one is used to thinking about in either insulating or metallic systems. Can one get analogous interesting physics if one thinks about phase transitions between topologically distinct states? And can spin orbit coupling, which kind of underlies a lot of this physics, also lead to unusual magnetism in the Mott insulating phase? So here is, one way one thinks about, traditionally thinks about correlation physics is to say, well, if we have oxides, in particular, oxides of transition metals, 3D transition metals, then one signature of strong correlation that's very familiar is the very robust appearance of magnetism in these systems. And of course, in the high TC superconductors, also the emergence of superconductors. Okay, so if one looks at 3D oxides, they are kind of a playground for understanding strong correlation physics, and all the temperature scales for these correlation phenomena are very high. On the other hand, if one thinks about things like band topology, one really thinks about having spin orbit coupling, and one is naturally led to thinking about the 4D and 5D elements where the heavier atoms lead to a stronger spin orbit effect. And so the question is, how can one, can one get both these ingredients in a system? And one other thing is, if one looks at correlated 3D oxides, spin-orbit coupling is rather weak. So one expects that correlation physics is strong, but spin-orbit coupling is weak. On the other hand, if we look at simple 5D oxides, it's clear that spin-orbit coupling is enormous. Atomic spin-orbit coupling is on the level of half an electron volt, but correlation effects are very weak. So for instance, if we look at things like rhenium oxide or iridium oxide, these are kind of electrocatalysts, they are very good metals, but there is no trace of magnetism or any evident strong correlation physics in these systems. There are recent examples of ternary oxides, like strontium iridate, where you get, you know, the Mott physics associated with magnetism. But if one think about quantum anomalous Hall states, one needs both a conduction electron fluid and the magnetism to be present at the same time. And so the question is, can one sort of go beyond some of these oxides? And it turns out that double perovskites play kind of an interesting role here. But the interest kind of more generally is to do with oxide engineering. Okay? Can one actually make, you know, grow oxides with different properties and kind of try and mix and match properties one wants from these different materials. So very recent work in oxide superlattices in the last several years has shown that you can actually layer by layer grow these oxides along different directions, let's say along the 001 or along the 111 direction. And you could, for instance, even grow things like one layer of a 3D oxide and one layer of a 5D oxide, which in principle will allow you to combine the physics of correlations as well as strong spin-orbit coupling. So at the level of a single atom, if one thinks about strong correlation physics in these systems, then in the class of double perovskites, it's precisely the fact that if you go along the 111 direction of the system, it precisely corresponds to laying down one triangular layer of one oxide and then a second triangular layer of another oxide. Okay. So double perovskites are very naturally grown by just taking these oxide MB growth processes and doing it along the 111 direction. So a very commonly studied one is the strontium iron molybdenum oxide, which was in fact like one of the early identification of something which is a high TC half metallic ferromagnet. And the components there are iron, and iron is a 3D 5 state here with 5 electrons, all of which line up because of Hund's coupling into a giant, almost classical moment. On molybdenum or, you know, any of these other ones, and we'll talk about, you know, rhenium, for instance, is another one, what you have is a T2G orbital where you just have one electron present. The EG orbital is too far up in energy to matter for the physics. So if you have this one electron, spin-orbit coupling in molybdenum, in these 4D transition metals is typically about 100 millivolts, and the spin-orbit coupling splits this T2G manifold into a J3 half and a J equal to 1 half manifold, and all the physics then consists of this single electron in this J equal to 3 half manifold, and that's what dominates the physics. So what if we put these two together? So we have a big classical moment on iron and the spin-orbit coupled conduction electron on molybdenum. And what drives conduction then is that you have hopping of electrons from one site to the other. So if a molybdenum electron wants to move onto an iron site, Hund's rule tells you that all these spins are lined up. So the only place that the molybdenum can land is if its spin points exactly opposite to the spin of the underlying classical moment. And so that's what happens, that's what drives ferromagnetism in the system. So if all the ferromagnetic moments are misaligned, this molybdenum electron finds it very hard to undergo conduction, whereas if all the ferromagnetic moments line up, then the kinetic energy of delocalization basically drives this ordering phenomenon. Okay? And so that gives rise to very high temperature ferromagnetism in these systems. And so what we've looked at is layered versions of this material. So imagine now you go along the 111 direction of this cubic crystal, and where you can actually now do layer by layer growth. But now let's say you grow one layer of iron oxide and one layer of molybdenum oxide. That forms a bilayer, which forms this kind of honeycomb lattice where one sublattice is molybdenum with conduction electrons having spin-orbit coupling, the other being iron, which is a classical local moment. And what one would like to ask is the physics of these things as they sort of talk to each other. So here is what happens. So it turns out that much as in bulk, it's the delocalization of these molybdenum electrons actually drives all the ferromagnetic moments to line up. So the ground state, it turns out, is not a kind of paramagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic or stripe type organization of the moments, but rather a ferromagnetic organization that leads to the lowest energy. Furthermore, because of spin-orbit coupling, not all directions of the magnetic moment are equally likely. It turns out that depending on parameters, the lowest energy in this case is for spins pointing along the 110 direction. But if one changes parameters, you can have spins pointing along the 111 direction. In other words, you can have spins that, depending on parameters, either point in the plane or out of the plane of this oxide. And if one computes sort of what the physics of these electronic bands is in the presence of this magnetic order, one finds, depending again on parameters, which you know one can imagine tuning by changing strain and so on, is that you can either get normal insulating phases, or you can get churn insulator phases, which are really like quantum anomalous Hall states. You can get metallic churn phase, churn bands, where you get bands with non-trivial churn number, but they overlap in energy, so any band is only partially filled as opposed to being completely filled. And so in some of these quantum anomalous Hall phases, you get churn number two. What that means is if you look at the edge spectrum, there are two chiral edge states in these materials. So it'd be interesting to actually explore this because these are systems which become ferromagnetic at very high temperatures. Even in films, we expect a ferromagnetic ordering at about 200 to 250 Kelvin, and quantum Hall gaps on the scale of about 75 Kelvin in this calculation. So what drives these quantum Hall states? And the quantum Hall states are actually now, to go back to where it came from, the molybdenum electrons live in this J equal to 3/2 manifold, but time reversal symmetry breaking because of the ion moments, Zeeman splits those levels. And all the action basically happens in the lowest two sublevels of this Zeeman split manifold, where the two states corresponds to J. I've written it as JZ being 3/2 and 1/2, but Z direction really corresponds to the direction normal to the plane. So it's the 111 direction. And these are half metals, okay, which means the spin part is completely polarized. And so the physics of these two orbitals is really that you have some complex superposition of orbitals that is present at each site on the molybdenum. And now hopping between these orbitals becomes complex and direction dependent. Okay? And so what that gives rise to is if I go along a certain direction, XY orbitals hop to each other, if I look at interorbital hopping, and it's purely real, whereas in other directions, YZ orbitals hop to each other and they acquire a phase factor. And similarly, if I go in the third direction, XZ orbitals hop and they acquire yet another phase factor. So it's this complex interorbital hopping that drives a formation of a skirmion or a double skirmion in this case in band space. Okay, so one can effectively describe this band topology using these lowest two levels, and that tells us why these kinds of churn bands or quantum anomalous Hall phases arise in these systems. So from here, we were actually led to thinking also about phase transitions between such quantum anomalous Hall states. In particular here, there is, in parameter space here, there is a phase transition between a normal insulator in yellow and a churn insulator with churn number two in green. And it turns out that this transition is driven by, basically you have to have two bands that exchange churn numbers. And it turns out that a band, one of these bands transfers two churn, transfers essentially sort of you transition from a band with churn number zero, two bands each having churn number zero, to two bands where the churn number changes by two. So you get plus two and minus two churn numbers for the bands. And the way this happens is at the critical point, there's a quadratic band touching at the gamma point in these. So one can ask, okay, here is a topological phase transition. I go from one type of quantum Hall state to another type of quantum Hall state. And at the non-interacting critical point just corresponds to a simple quadratic band touching. But now we can ask, well, what interactions do at such a transition? And it turns out that because it's quadratic band touching, density of states is finite and interactions are marginally relevant at this transition. And what they do is the following, that it turns out that there's a single marginally relevant interaction. And what it gives rise to is actually a phase that breaks the rotational symmetry of the crystal. So what we have is in the absence of this order parameter, in the absence of interactions, one would have a system where the Hall conductance goes from being 2 in units of E squared over H to being 0. And then at finite temperature, there is a smooth crossover, which kind of looks reasonably, you can sort of identify it, but it's a smooth crossover at finite temperature. But once interactions are turned on, it turns out that the system spontaneously breaks the C6 symmetry of the crystal and gives rise to a nematic order that has this kind of dome structure in parameter space. So this gives an example of, you know, a system where in the absence of interactions, you would have thought that this is just some simple non-interacting, you know, phase transition between two topologically distinct phases. And yet, once interactions are included, there is a kind of emergence of a new phase that's unexpected in this non-interacting picture that has this kind of liquid crystal character. So I'm going to switch gears a bit in the last, I guess, 5 minutes or 10 minutes, okay. And talk about some other, so are there actually any questions on this part? Because I'm going to switch gears and talk about Morton Slater physics in the remaining, you know, 10 minutes. But if people have questions about this quantum Hall physics, I can sort of talk about it. Yeah? So, yeah, this is for bilayer. So in bulk, it's known to be a ferromagnet at about 400 Kelvin. People have done measurements of transport, and the transport has this kind of characteristic upturn at low temperatures, which is very indicative of this kind of spin wall physics that you talked about, that there's blocking of spins from going from one grain to the other. And so with magnetic field, people have seen that this becomes from a resistance upturn to a regular metallic behavior. But other than that, there have not been that much, there is not that much more known in bulk. So one thing we are hoping to sort of, get people to do, so people at, so like in Arkansas, there's Jack Chakalian and Trisconi in Geneva, so they are actually started growing some of these, things along the 111 direction, and Takagi more recently. So they're sort of hoping to sort of interest them in trying to look at films of this system. So even the anomalous Hall effect, for instance, has not been measured. I mean, we predict a big anomalous Hall effect even in just the metallic SFMO, but it's not so far actually been measured in these systems. Yeah. Okay, if there are no other questions, I'll kind of switch to kind of the last part of the talk. And that has to do with the effect of spin-orbit coupling in thinking about magnetism in these Morton-Slater double perovskites. So here, you know, as I mentioned, we have two sublattices in this cubic crystal, and we'll take examples where one of these sublattices is just an inert closed shell atom and it plays no role in the physics, whereas on the other sublattice, we will imagine a magnetic ion. And it turns out there's a huge variety of these which have been grown primarily by John Greeden and his collaborators, where, you know, one of them, for instance, you know, the inert one could be, you know, either yttrium or, you know, I've given all examples of yttrium here, but you can have, you know, yttrium or you can have other varieties like magnesium, for instance, and so you can change this charge state of this A sublattice ion. And on the B sublattice ion, you can sort of put in various kinds of, you know, 3D, 4D, 5D elements. And it turns out that, you know, these remain well separated. Provided the charge state and so on are sufficiently different, these actually order into what are called ordered double perovskites, where in fact these ions arrange in this perfect bipartite kind of two sublattice fashion. And so by looking at now, you can think about magnetism of these ions, and because the charge and spin orbit coupling, all of these change, you can explore the physics of magnetism with very, very different magnetic moment sizes, with very different sizes of spin-orbit coupling. And so there's a whole host of systems here which one can study and which indeed have been studied partly, you know, just by looking at thermodynamic measurements, but more recently by Bruce Gollan using neutron scattering measurements from his group. So the ones I'll kind of focus on today is sort of is a collaboration that is sort of ongoing with Oak Ridge. And these are examples of iridate double perovskites. So zinc here is the inert, zinc or magnesium is the inert element, and iridium is in a D5 configuration, which leads to basically four electrons in the J3 half manifold and one lone electron in the J1 half manifold. Okay? So we have a single lone electron in a J1 half manifold, and so this acts like an analog of a spin half magnetic moment. And there are lots of examples of these which have been studied in the past few years in sort of perovskite iridates or this kind of a layered perovskite iridate or honeycomb lattice, where people imagine that these are examples of you know, systems Mott insulators which can exhibit exotic magnetic interactions. So what about these iridate double perovskites? So these have a small Curie-wise temperature. It's about 24 Kelvin, and it's antiferromagnetic. And these are expected to be very deep in the Mott phase, simply because, you know, unlike strontium iridate, where these oxygen or these octahedra of these elements sit right next to each other, here they are kind of better separated octahedra. And so, in fact, the hopping of electrons is much weaker compared to the strontium iridates or the sodium iridates, and the corresponding Curie-wise temperature is small. That tells you it's deep in the Mott phase. And the systems order at about 10 Kelvin. So these are not systems which are, you know, spin liquids or anything. They are kind of ordered phases. But yet it gives us an opportunity to think about more generally about magnetism of these spin orbit coupled moments on the FCC lattice, which is geometrically frustrated. So if we look at the honeycomb iridates or the hyperhoneycomb lithium iridates, simply based on symmetry grounds, one can argue that the exchange interactions must be interesting, because unlike Heisenberg interactions, which don't care about spatial directions, they are completely rotationally invariant in spin space. Here, space and spin get coupled, and that means symmetry allows for more types of interactions. And in particular, if you look at one slice through this FCC crystal, we have these iridium ions. And if you look at a given plane of this crystal, then purely on symmetry grounds for a cubic crystal, one can argue that the exchanges, in addition to Heisenberg terms, will allow for Ising-like or other directional couplings. And so the question is, you know, first question is, you know, are these directional couplings strong? Can they drive any interesting physics? And is there evidence for these kinds of directional couplings in any specific materials, in particular in the context of these double perovskites? So here is just the phase diagram illustrating what happens as we tune these non-Heisenberg couplings relative to the strength of the Heisenberg term. So at the origin here is a pure Heisenberg, nearest neighbor Heisenberg model in the FCC lattice. That is frustrated, but orders because of thermal order by disorder in a classical system into what's called an A-type, A1-type antiferromagnet, which is you have planes which order ferromagnetically, but layers are coupled antiferromagnetically to one another. And it turns out that, in fact, a lot of these double perovskite magnets, in fact, order into this kind of a simple pattern. But we find that as we tune away from the Heisenberg limit, it turns out that there are various other types of magnetic orders, including, you know, various stripe-like or spiral-like phases that can emerge in the system. But another thing that happens is that the window of these kinds of, you know, ordered, you know, A1 type orders actually becomes very robust. Okay? So one thing you could ask is, well, if A type order appears in the Heisenberg limit and also away from the Heisenberg limit, you know, how do I know spin orbit coupling even plays a role in a given material? Maybe it's just a Heisenberg model, and we don't know anything more than that. But it turns out that both thermodynamic and neutron scattering measurements actually give us more insight into the physics. So let me not go into the details of this. It turns out the following. So if I take a pure Heisenberg model on an FCC crystal, it turns out that the ordering, because it's geometrically frustrated, turns out to be rather weak. So what I mean by that is that there's a very large frustration parameter, or the ratio of the Curie-wise temperature to the ordering temperature is enormous. It's like a factor of 10. On the other hand, in these materials, it turns out that the ordering temperature and the Curie-wise temperature are not all that different. They're off by a factor of 2. So this tells us that, you know, that it cannot be a simple Heisenberg antiferromagnet, that spin orbit coupling must play a role in locking the magnetic moments to certain directions, perhaps relieving the frustration physics in these systems. And so indeed, if we sort of compute the ratio of this Curie-wise to the ordering temperature, which is what I call the frustration parameter, in the absence of these Ising-like or, you know, these anisotropic interactions, It's huge. It's like maybe 9 here for a spin half system. But as these Ising couplings go up, the ordering temperature also increases, and this frustration parameter effectively decreases. So it turns out here we estimate that in fact a better starting point for these iridate, FCC iridate materials is one where the Ising coupling is actually the dominant interaction, but we're still kind of trying to understand the microscopic reasons for this physics. So the minimal interaction that would sort of describe this physics is one where you have different Ising spin directions interacting along in different planes. So if you take the XY plane of the crystal, the nearest neighbor moments interact through an SZ-SZ interaction. If you take the similarly the YZ plane, it would be the SSXX moments that interact. And so in fact, even though this looks like an Ising model, it's a quantum Ising model because different directions don't commute with one another. So it turns out that the system exhibits the following. It also has this, even this limit, not just the Heisenberg limit, even this pure Ising limit orders into the same A1 type ordering, namely you have ferromagnetic planes that order antiferromagnetically, that are stacked antiferromagnetically. But there are two kind of important differences when these Ising couplings are present. The first is that there is a quantum order by disorder. In other words, you know, just like in the FCC crystal, the direction in which you know you point is going to be spontaneously chosen. Okay? But in contrast to let me back up. So in an FCC crystal, it turns out that there is a lot of possible choices of ordering. And what this, on the other hand, does is it cuts down the number of ordering choices that you have. Okay? So it kind of decreases frustration to some extent, but you're still left with an uncertainty in the direction in which the magnetic moment can point, and quantum order by disorder actually pins the direction of the magnetic moments to be along the iridium-oxygen bond direction. And because this is no longer a symmetry of the crystal, in other words, spin rotational symmetry is broken, it turns out that this quantum order by disorder also leads to a gap in the magnetic spectrum, which has actually been measured in neutron scattering. So this is neutron scattering on the magnesium iridate, and what is found is a nearly dispersionless gap excitation. If we calculate for a Heisenberg model, we find this very, very different dispersion. But if we do the same calculation for this Ising-like model, we find something that's in much better agreement with the data if we realize that you know things here at low Q are cut off because of just neutron kinematics in these spallation sources. So what is seen here is kind of reminiscent of you know what is calculated in this region of the if momentum space. So let me close here. So just to summarize, we have studied both metallic and Mott insulating double perovskites. In the metallic systems, it turns out that the physics of anomalous Hall and quantum anomalous Hall effects plays an important role, but you know it would be actually worth doing these experiments to look for these physics, In the Mott insulating double perovskites, we have uncovered sort of unusual magnetic exchange interactions, which seems consistent with some of the neutron data on these materials. And in fact, these kind of gapped spin excitations are found in a large variety of other double perovskites, including certain osmates that have been recently studied by Bruce Gollin and John Greeden. And in fact, some of this physics of you know unusual magnetic exchange probably also plays a role in the physics of those materials. So with that, I close here and thank you for your attention.
So maybe a couple of quick questions.
Something that's interested and confused me about the magnetic structures in a lot of these double perovskites, the A-type antiferromagnetism, is that it's not consistent with the cubic structure, right? Because it breaks the translational symmetry in whatever the stacking direction is. And so how do you understand the it occurs in lots of these systems, but how do you understand the coexistence of that antiferromagnetic structure with a perfect cubic system? Or do you expect there to be a small distortion?
Yeah, so in this particular iridate, it turns out it's not perfectly cubic. So it turns out that these are actually monoclinic structures. So there is a small distortion of the magnetic moments, which is consistent with the monoclinic structure. But you're right that if you had a perfectly cubic system, you would also expect a structural distortion to occur with the onset of this kind of magnetic order, some kind of tetragonal distortion to accompany this magnetic order. So I know that in some other materials, so for instance, in the barium rhenium oxide, iron rhenium oxide, it's a metallic system, but there is very similar, you know, there is a ferromagnetic order that nominally breaks the crystal symmetry. But it's only now with, you know, with some Raman data that people have found that there's like some, you know, fraction of a percent change in the lattice constant. So it distorts from cubic to tetragonal, but it's extremely weak. And so, I mean, maybe in the insulators one might expect a stronger effect because kind of more localized, and maybe it kind of is at the level of, I guess the degree of orbital ordering in an insulator might be stronger accompanying this kind of magnetic order. But these, the ones I'm looking at are actually monoclinic, so this cubic is kind of an approximation to the structure. Yeah.
Okay, maybe one more very quick question.
Hi. So I want to ask you about the, you said that there is an emergent nematicity.
Sorry?
At the critical point, you have an emergent nematicity.
Mm-hmm.
So is that with respect to the curvature of the band that flows to, like, you get, you start with a isotropic curvature, and then you develop some anisotropy in the curvature of the band. Is that what you, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
So when you start with the quantum, if you're in the quantum Hall insulator, then it would be two gapped, nearly isotropic, you know, consistent with C6 symmetry. And then it turns out that you pull down two points, which will eventually go into some kind of a Dirac, two Dirac points that will touch rather than a quadratic mantle. So,
Okay, let's thank Arun again. And so this concludes the first session.